All right. Well, welcome everyone to the Value Add Strategy. We're joined today by my very good friend, Brad Heckerman, who I've known for a number of years. Brad, thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here. Yeah.
Perfect. Perfect. Well, I'd love to get started and share with the viewers a little bit on your background, if you don't mind, where you grew up, what your beginning family life was like, and kind of how that shaped who you've become today and some of the successes that you've been able to accomplish.
Okay, sure. I'd be glad to do that. I think to go back, you almost have to go back to December 7th, 1941, when my mom and dad were at a matinee in a little town called Belt, Montana, they were from that area, and they came out to the news that Japan had bombed Pearl Harbor. And that event had my father join the military, and he always wanted to fly. And his dad had died when he was 7 years old, and he was extremely poor, raised poor, without a father and a mom with three boys to raise, and he was the oldest of the three. So long story short, my dad became a fighter pilot. And he is a fighter pilot and served throughout World War II in that role. And then graduated, went to Montana State University in aeronautical engineering, graduated in 3 years. He flew crop dusters and charter flights during that time, got recalled in Korea. But because he was working on some classified projects, they wouldn't let him go to combat, which was a problem for my dad. And because he was dissatisfied, let's say, with the military at that point in time, the commanding officer at Wright Patt Air Force Base asked him what his problem was. And he said he wanted to fly, and he was a fighter pilot. And he said, well, how about if we make you a test pilot? And so that's how my dad became a test pilot. And we tease people that my dad's claim to fame was he was one of the first three men to test ejection seats. And my dad ultimately flew with Chuck Yeager and some of those people. And we didn't learn about that until he was in his 80s. So if you realize that I was raised by a fighter pilot, military type attitude, my older brother was born at Wright Patt Air Force Base in Dayton. I was born in Southern California. My dad had got assigned down there. And then ultimately when he left the military, Matt, he decided to stay in the aviation business and started his own company as a sales rep. Representing aviation firms. And so I was born there, but every summer, starting when I was 10 years old, my family would ship me to the ranches and farms in Montana, my grandparents' place, my aunt and uncle's place. And so I grew up in my summers, working cows and haying and harvesting wheat. That was kind of what my summers were. And during that time, I just absolutely fell in love with Montana. So when people ask, how the connection to Montana was here, my grandparents were here, all my aunts and uncles were here. My mom and dad literally grew up here. And so I went to college and finished college at the University of Montana. And the reason I chose the University of Montana, Matt, was at the time, it had the third best school of accounting and finance in the country. And, so often schools are rated kind of off a political environment. But what was important to me then was that the way this rating went was what percentage of the students passed all parts of the CPA exam the first time out. And the University of Montana had better scores that way than Harvard, Stanford, Yale, a lot of the top schools. So I knew I could get a good education. I could do it here in Montana. And that's what I did.
So you were born and you were kind of born in Southern California.
I was. I grew up a proverbial surfer boy.
Really?
The water, the ocean, okay. Surfing, sailing, scuba diving. That was what I loved to do when I was young.
Where in Southern California?
Down in a coastal town called Playa del Rey.
Oh, okay. Near LA.
Just south of Marina del Rey.
Yeah. Beautiful. And then started working as a young boy on the farm and learned the value of hard work, it sounds like, during formative years, during the summer.
Yeah.
And that's amazing.
And hard work and responsibility, right?
Yep.
The animals got fed before you got fed type things. You're up at daybreak and you don't go to bed until well after sundown type thing. But it gave you a great work ethic and a sense of responsibility. It was a wonderful way to grow up that.
So I think that's kind of interesting. So, I'm raising two young sons, and I know you have a number of children. And, in today's day and age, you look at social media and technology and how much time these kids spend in front of screens versus perhaps what you did. And I started working young as well in my father's restaurant when I was 9 years old, washing dishes. And, I look back at that and say, boy, that really had a very favorable impact on my outcome and the value of a dollar and hard work. I mean, what would you have to say for somebody who's raising kids today, just comparing what you did, when you were very, very young and how that's shaped and impacted your life? How much different do you think it would be if you were, 10 years old today versus when you were 10 years old, back way back when? And what are the differences, would you say?
Well, I think because we're not as much of an agrarian society anymore, I think the young people don't have the opportunity to learn the kind of work and skills that we had. The idea of a long day's work was just normal. The idea that you worked hard and had responsibility. Those cows, if they didn't survive, you didn't eat. That was the bottom line. You were in a battle every day for survival. And you could have, let's say, a harvest of wheat, and that whole harvest, Matt, could come down to maybe a week or 10 days of harvest, a whole year's worth of work, and that could disappear in that week or 10 days from weather, from fire, from a lot of different things. So we were raised with the idea that you're part of a family and you're raised to contribute to the family. So there was a sense of community. There is a sense of family. If a neighbor had a problem, every neighbor was there. If you saw smoke on the horizon, you jumped in a pickup or you grabbed a tractor and you took off to the smoke because you knew there was a fire at a neighbor's place, whether it was in their wheat field or structural fire, and you were there to help.
It's amazing, the sense of community. I think that's something we've lost as a society today. There's a huge technological advances that has made us more efficient, but thinking of what you just said with that sense of community, where if you saw something going on your neighbor's property, you were there to help, and I'm sure vice versa, they were there to help you if you had any issues. And I think that's something that we're missing. But I'd like to go back if you don't mind. So you went to the University of Montana, if I understand correctly.
Correct. Yes, I was a grizzly.
Okay.
I'm a grizzly.
And what did you study?
I was a finance major.
Okay. And I know just my conversations with you, what I've been very interested in is just the value of statistics in your life. And was that something that you learned at the University of Montana? Because I know that really had shaped your business career and the success that you've had. Perhaps you could shed some light on that.
I'd be glad to, man. In fact, it's kind of an interesting story. When I graduated from the University of Montana, and here I'm going to one of the better finance schools in the country, but I didn't really understand wealth and wealth creation. One of the things that I did not understand, how could one individual have 1,000 times more wealth than another, but they didn't have 1,000 times more intellect, and they didn't have 1,000 times more hours in a day? So what principles and applications were they applying to their life that allowed them to have financial freedom? The school didn't really teach us that. But what did happen while I was going to school, Matt, and it was earlier, I started school and I went to Cal Poly at San Luis Obispo, and I transferred to the University of Montana. And I started at Cal Poly because I wanted to be a vet. And while I was at Cal Poly, the president of the university asked me if I would teach statistics to kids that had learning disabilities. I had a number of students that were blind, some were dyslexic. They would just generally have learning disabilities. When he asked me to do that, the question I had, Matt, was how do you get people who don't really have an interest in statistics interested in statistics? And so the idea that I came up with was to teach them game theory. To be a good teacher, what I learned through that is you have to become a good student. And I became a student of game theory and statistics. And that's where I got my interest in statistical probabilities and in the role that statistics can play in your life.
For those that don't know, could you just share the basic fundamentals of what game theory is?
Yes, Be glad to. Basically, Matt, what you're looking at is when you go to game, I mean, you're in Vegas as an example, right? When you go to game, it's what is the statistical probability that you will be able to win at that game? What are the odds? And how do you put those odds in your favor? Obviously, the house puts them in their favor. That's where all those casinos are so large and wealthy and fancy. But it's how do you basically look at whatever endeavor you're in, a game in this case, game theory, it could be blackjack, it could be cards, and put the odds in your favor. So an example of that that a lot of people find of interest is I put myself through the University of Montana by gaming. It's not necessarily something I'm most proud of, man, but it's what I did. I didn't have a 9-to-5 job like a lot of young people. I applied my skills at game theory, and the one game that I focused on most was five card stud. And if you think about why five card stud, and you think about the idea that you have one card down and four cards up, and it was the easiest of the games for me to figure out the mathematical probability that I had the winning hand or would have the winning hand by the time the deck was dealt.
So do you think it was more a function of you understood, I guess, a sense of card counting? You knew what cards have been dealt, what cards were used in the last hand, and you had a photographic memory, and you could just and take a snapshot of that in your mind and know what the odds were instantaneously, or were directionally you had an idea? Or can you help us understand that a little bit?
Yeah, I wish I had a photographic memory, Matt. That would have made it a lot easier.
Okay.
But the reality was I didn't. The reality was I had to work doing that math in my head and doing it very, very quickly. But one of the things that I think I had a natural talent or a natural gift for was the math side of that types of things. And, you know, a lot of individuals that I've worked with throughout my life, my wife as an example as well, says, Brad, numbers speak to you. When you see a set of numbers, you immediately understand the picture, whether it's a financial statement or whether it's the statistics, probabilities. So I guess they just spoke to me, man. But from that standpoint, if you look at our investing as an example and things that we do with you, it plays a key role in the areas we've chosen to invest in and what deals we invest in.
Well, that's it. It's interesting that I was actually just going to go there and we're jumping ahead, but I think it's an interesting segue. I will say this first, you know, being in Las Vegas, I'm sure the casinos, you're a nightmare to walk in. Guys like you are a nightmare for the casinos.
I was kicked out at 25 years old, Matt, and of Vegas. I've always had a burr under my saddle for Las Vegas because at 25 years old, I was applying game theory at the Dunes Hotel.
Wow.
And I was up, not a huge amount of money, but I was up enough for a 25-year-old guy that was feeling pretty good. And the management of the Dunes Hotel came to me and told me that gambling in their facility was a privilege. And I just lost mine. And I told them, I'm not cheating. I'm not doing anything illegal. I'm just using my head and a system that I put together. And they said, it doesn't matter. You've lost your privilege. So I thought, well, that's okay. I'd go across the street to the MGM and apply my skill sets there. And Matt, I was met shortly at MGM and basically told the same thing. And I thought, well, I'll go down the road and go to Caesar's Palace. And they told me the same thing. So I determined that I didn't have a future in Vegas.
So you basically took the edge from the house and shifted it to your advantage.
Think of it this way, Matt. What I'm about to share with you, I've never shared with anyone because I know how powerful it is. And it can take some people where they wouldn't work for a living, let's say, but they might think that they would game for a living. But the example I use best is back when Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders were running for office together, there was coin tosses. There was six coin tosses that supposedly Hillary Clinton won every one of them. The odds of her winning that first coin toss was 50%. The odds of her winning six in a row was 1.5%.
Wow. Lucky lady.
Now, if you knew that and you could have bet on those coin tosses, I was the guy that would bet on the 98.5% chance that she wasn't going to win six in a row instead of her one half. And Matt, the only thing that you can really control in gaming is you can control the game you're going to play. You can control how often you're going to bet, and you can control the size of your bet. And my system used those variables, put the odds in my favor, not in the house's favor.
And I mean, that's amazing. And not many people could do that. You have a philosophy and a winning edge. And how well do you think that translates into what you do today in investing?
Well, the first place I translated into on investing was commodities trading. So when I was building my first manufacturing businesses, and we can talk about those if you want to later, but while I was doing that, I was trading commodities. And back then, you didn't have the computers, right? You couldn't trade from your desk or whatever. You had to go down to an office and place your orders and that type of thing. Where I was placing my orders, they had 1,600 accounts. And being naturally competitive, I asked the manager, where did I sit in those 1,600 individuals that were trading? And he said, you had the third highest amount of wins and the largest amount of money. And so using statistics, let's just say, put me in number three position out of 1,600, Matt. But I use statistics in commodities trading. And the one thing that's different about commodities trading, maybe than real estate investing, investing in stocks and bonds, is it's a zero-sum game. Someone has to take the other side of your contract. So for every dollar that you make, someone else loses a dollar other than what is taken out in between by, let's say, the broker or whoever's arranging the trade. So it's not like a stock where you could buy it for $5, sell it for $10. The guy that buys it for $10 takes it up to $20 type thing. Or we buy real estate at one price, we sell it for a profit. The next owner holds it for a number of years and they sell it for a profit. It was a zero-sum game. And at the time, I don't know what the statistics are today, Matt. I don't know what the data would be today. But at the time, about 25% of the traders won, made money, and 75% lost in commodities. And I was fortunate enough to be one of the ones that won. But what's most interesting is when people ask, how did you get there, Brad? And it was, I'd use statistics, Matt, and I traded grains and I traded gold and silver. That was it. That's what I stuck with, what I knew or thought I knew or had some background in. But when I would trade, I would look at charts, look at production costs. I'd look at all the data. And if you think of a normal bell-shaped curve, and most prices on commodities generally flow around similar to a bell-shaped curve. And if you understand statistics and standard deviations, when the price of a product, whether high or low, got into the second standard deviation, which meant 85% of the time it's below or above that price, I would start to get interested in that. And when it got deep into that standard deviation, i.e. 95% of the time, 93% of the time, I would turn what I called the radar on, and I'd start pinging and watching and paying very, very close attention, and then try to time my trade. Because obviously, if I could, let's say, buy a commodity, or 98% of the time, or 97.5% of the time, it had traded above that price, I had reduced my risk dramatically. And what that whole experience taught me, Matt, was I would go months without a trade at all because I'm waiting for the trade to set up. And in our family office, you'll hear all of our people would be able to tell you, Brad will keep pounding on us, wait for the trade to set up. Wait for the trade to set up. Because those other 1,600 guys and gals that were trading back in the day, Matt,
yep.
They felt to be a commodities trader, they had to always have a trade on.
And you wanted to wait for the rest.
That might be true, but if you're trading in that first standard deviation, where half the time it's above this price or below this price, you're in a much more difficult situation than if you're competing against a guy like myself that just waits and waits and waits to know that something's a good value. Even when our children would want to know in the most simple terms about what dad had done or what dad would do, I'd use the idea of them going shopping. We have three girls they enjoy shopping that, you know, like a lot of girls do. Sometimes even big girls enjoy the shopping, but
that's right.
You know, they would go shopping. I'd say to them, do you know what the price of the product should be? What that normally is? Yeah, Dad, of course. Do you know a good deal when you see it, when it's really a low price or a sale price or a clear out price? And they would say, of course. And so I'd tell them, you know, it's very similar concept. You're just looking for good value when you put your trade on.
Well, that's exactly what I was going to say. You sound like a classic value investor that brings to the table, you know, some algorithms that you had internally. You know, at that time, I don't know how much you used algorithms, and I'm sure there was no AI present, Excel spreadsheets. You kind of had this math, as you call it, in your head, and it allowed you to set the trade up, as you'd like to call it. And then you would execute when the odds were in your favor.
And that's exactly right, Matt. We're in five areas of real estate: mobile home communities with you, of course, self-storage, Class B apartments, we're industrial, light industrial properties, and we're in single family build-to-rent communities. Now, why are we in those five, Matt?
Yep, exactly.
Why is my favorite mobile home communities?
Yeah, please share.
I've had numerous discussions about how I'd love to have you be more into mobile home communities and maybe even less into self-storage.
Yeah.
But when I did the homework, Matt, on those five areas, and we have a 27-item checklist that we don't always check off every item in that checklist before we make an investment. But we check out the majority of them. And when I did the homework for mobile home communities, and over a 20-year period, what percentage of mobile home communities had the keys handed back to them, to the bank, or to the lenders? As an example, it was less than 0.5% that had met all that criteria. Matt, as a stat guy, if I have a 99.5% chance or better of making money or not losing money, I'm interested in that investment.
That's a good statistical advantage right there. I like that. Well, it makes sense. You've chosen some of the best asset classes in the commercial real estate that are available to us. You know, a lot of groups are really getting hurt right now on office. And it's interesting because we're seeing, and you know this because you and I have had this discussion, we're seeing a lot of institutional capital flood into manufactured housing and self-storage. And I think it's because they're pivoting out of these other asset classes that haven't performed for them, you know, namely office. And they're looking for safe, predictable cash flow streams. They're looking for supply and demand dynamics, which are in their favor. And you and I definitely agree on manufactured housing being by far the safest asset class to invest in. So it really is an honor to have you part of our fund and being a limited partner. And, you know, we have deeper conversations than the typical GPLP would. And I'm just honored, you know, to have you part of what we're doing here. But in the future, what do you, for your family office, what are your plans in terms of exposure to asset classes? If you look across the five different asset classes that you named, do you plan to allocate equally across all five of them, or is it more of a lopsided approach?
No, it's a lopsided approach. And again, that lopsided approach is based on a couple of criteria, Matt. The first one is what gives us the lowest risk of losing money. If you look at when I was trading commodities, or if you look at gaming, Matt, the most important thing you can do to have an overall decent investment return is to not take a huge loss. And the one thing I learned,
don't lose
that
money.
When it's difficult for people, myself included, is to have a losing trade and to learn to cut your losses short and let your profits run. You know, we hear that all the time. It sounds so simple, but it is hard to do in practice. And I had to learn that lesson. And so we, you know, would put stop losses in back in the day. I put a hard stop and it didn't matter about that. An example, Matt, of staying with what you know and not getting outside of your expertise or your lane was when I was mentioning to you that I'd trade, I was in the office one day and I'm talking about the commodities office, and they have the screens up, right? And the screens are up for the S&P 500 and the general stock market. And I'm looking at that graph and I'm thinking about some Fibonacci numbers and a few other things. And I think, you know what? There's a good chance that that S&P is going to take a bounce up and maybe I'll just put a trade on. So I did. Fortunately, I only took one position, Matt, because it took me about 15 minutes to get back to my office. And when I got back to the office, my administrative assistant told me that I had an important call to make back to the commodities trading office. Well, I knew that couldn't be good news, Matt. So I called him back and they told me, Brad, it took me about 15 minutes, like I said, to drive back. And they said, you've been closed out. You've been stopped out. So in 15 minutes, Matt, I lost enough money that they got my attention. And
what happened?
Think of it this way. That was on a Friday before Black Monday. If I hadn't been able to set my stop and get out, who knows what the damage would have been on Monday.
Wow.
It might have gapped down where I couldn't have gotten out on my stop. So I learned the lessons of, you know, cut your losses short. And we've had some, like every investor, Matt, we've had some losses.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a big lesson in this game. You know, if you're going to invest for the long term, inevitably you're going to take a loss. It's just how much further are your wins going to outstrip those losses, and what are your overall returns going to look like? And do you have a philosophy?
You know, what's a common theme for us in our private equity investments when we've taken a loss? What would you think the one number one common theme is, Matt?
Well, I think you hit on don't lose money.
We chose the wrong partner, Matt. So when we look at what we invest in today, we require three things. I've learned, if you really want to have a good operator, a good partner like Crystal View has been for us so far, the first thing is they got to bring absolute integrity to the party, Matt. Absolute.
Okay.
And we view honesty is having something in common with pregnancy. You're not kind of pregnant.
You are, you're not.
You are, you're not.
Yeah.
So when we're analyzing our sponsors, we hold that criteria that let's not try to do business with someone that's kind of honest. Let's try to find people that are, and they have that integrity. The second one is that they bring a lot of experience into the area and a track record and a proven track record over a long period of time that they can validate and verify to us, and that they'll be transparent enough to do that and to show us that they are who they say they are, and their track record is what they say it is. And then the last is capital, that they have to bring capital and skin into the game. And I think I can speak for, Matt, a lot of your potential investors, that if they look closely at the capital structure of some of the sponsorships that they are invited to participate in, there's either very little or really no skin in the game from the side of the sponsor, the way they allocate their expenses and their capital structure.
I think that's a big deal. And, you know, a lot of potential investors come to me and they ask a series of questions. And most cases, they'll say, what question didn't I ask you? And I'll tell them, you forgot the most important question. And they'll say, well, what is that? And I'll say, you forgot to ask me how much of my own money am I putting at stake here?
Yep.
In the game, we eat our own cooking. And the beauty there is we're going to win or lose together, but we're going to think about it like an owner. Because a lot of these groups, they fall into this sponsorship category where they're just generating fees at the end of the day. Yes, of course, they want to win. It's not as though it's malicious and they want to lose, but are they really thinking about their decisions as an owner? And the only way I think that's going to happen is if you have your own money and a significant portion of your own money, you know, not 1%, but a good percentage there. Then you're going to come across every decision and you're going to think very deeply and hard about it because you are an owner. You're not just going to do things to generate fees. You're going to do things that are going to generate the best overall return for the fund or the sponsorship or the syndication, whatever it is that you're the GP for. So I think you're spot on there on your three rules. And how do you vet these sponsors or these potential investment opportunities to find out if they are honest, to get their track record. And an easy one is to find out how much of their own money they put in. But can you maybe walk us through that process?
Sure, sure. I think one of the things I was fortunate with earlier in my life, Matt, was I had good mentors. And so even when I had my manufacturing, my first manufacturing business that I was involved with, I was in my 20s. And at least I was smart enough to know that I didn't know. So I asked for help in putting a board of directors together. And even though my uncle and I owned a company, we were not chairman of our own board. We had self-made millionaires that were in our area of expertise, manufacturing, and who had done it. And we asked them to be the board. And one of them mentored me something that was very interesting, Matt, and very effective, by the way. When he would grill me, as the CEO of the company, we'd be in a board meeting. He'd grill me all these questions, right? And at the very end, the last question was, and did you lie about any of the previous questions to me? And Matt, that was a real educational experience, right?
Sure.
So to answer your question, as we're trying to vet our sponsors, the first thing we look at is an attitude of fairness, is the way that they are structuring their expenses, their remuneration, and their capital stack. Is it fair to the limited partners? If that structure is not fair, and we can talk about specific numbers if you want, but we have numbers in our head that are fair, and anything outside of those numbers, we won't proceed with that sponsor, no matter what the track record is. We believe that we want to work with people that would treat us and will treat us the same way that we'd want to treat them in all business dealings. And so if they bring what we think is not a fair structure, we say no. Once you get past the fair structure, then there's a lot of things you can do. As far as the internet allowed you to do a lot of research, but we'll ask to speak to the accountants, bank, attorneys, others.
Okay.
And if, because of the amount of money, Matt, that we typically invest and what our minimum is for a deal for my wife and I and our team, that minimum, which is $250,000, is a lot of money to us. We can build orphanages and we can take care of a lot of kids, Matt, with $250,000.
Absolutely.
So we do our due diligence as best we can. But, you know, I don't think we've added a sponsor in the last 2 years. And that's how hard it is to make the cut for us.
That's exactly what I was going to ask. Is it because sponsors aren't making the cut? Or when you kind of take a look at the landscape that's out there and assess opportunities and capital markets and where we are in the cycle, are you skittish, or is it more a function of I'm not finding the right sponsor I'm comfortable with, or a combination of both?
It's a combination of both, Matt. If we look at, we don't do a lot of public market work. We do some. And the public market we do with is fairly sophisticated, where we write a lot of puts and calls against our position, and we choose stocks that are favorable in that area. But if you look at the historic valuation of the public markets right now, it's extremely high. So we're not prone to want to be long in these markets. One of the things that has concern to us that you and I visit about is the cap rate, even for mobile home communities.
Yeah.
And you and I have discussed that. We have some concerns there. So unless you can find a property that's been mismanaged, where you can bring in a fairly significant growth in the ROI and the net pre-tax profitability because of improvements that Crystal View brings, Matt, we think that this is a hazardous time, that a lot of things have gotten highly valued. Apartment complexes in certain markets have been that way. Just recently, I read where almost 50% of the new units that came on in certain markets in the third quarter of last year, 3 months later, they're only half full.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, some of these markets are oversupplied. We've had this, we're not multifamily. Of course, manufactured housing is moving to our largest investment, but being in storage, that's one of the large concerns is supply and demand. You know, because as new supply comes into markets, especially if you're in lease up mode, you got to really understand that market, because if not, you're going to be in a position where you're not going to hit your underwriting assumptions and your occupancy is going to be, to your point, significantly less than what you initially underwrote, which is problematic. And we're seeing some of that distress on the storage side. And the irony is in more of the primary markets. When you look at the Dallases of the worlds and the Denvers and the LAs and the New Yorks, those large metros are becoming oversupplied more so than these smaller secondary and tertiary markets. But no, I think in terms of the cap rate discussion, you know, historically, cap rates are almost at an all-time low, certainly compared to where interest rates are and the tariffs and a lot of uncertainty out there. Who knows where rates are going to go? So it's a very uncertain environment. We're seeing a lot of investors on the sidelines. And I'd love to get your take over time. Do you think more, at least more of your family office capital, are you going to put more shorts on the market, giving your apprehension around valuations, or would you go and make larger allocations into these safer investments that you really have high conviction in, namely the manufactured housing sector?
It's a great question, Matt. If you think back to my tendency to look at the statistical side, if you look at general markets in the U.S. and with the debasement of a currency, you're better off to be long than you are to be short. So I'm not by nature a guy that likes to be short. I've gone short and I would go short, but only in special circumstances. I'm more comfortable and our team is more comfortable being long, betting on the economy of America, betting on the people of America, betting on our partnerships that are well vetted. You know, we're more prone to be, like I said, long than short. One of the things that we do, or we try to do, Matt, that puts the odds in our favor, we feel, and it was the same way with my manufacturing businesses. My managers were highly incentivized, and I mean highly incentivized, to get us to operate in the top 2 to 5% of all firms in our industry. If you think about what I just said, Matt, we want to see Crystal View operate there. We think you do operate close to there, if not there. But what does that mean if you're even at the 5%, it means that you're beating 19 out of 20 companies and you're the 20th company. So to really have a competitor, you have to have 40 firms in your space for you to have another competitor that's really not geared out with you. So we would follow those metrics for our type of business. Back in the day, there was a group called Robert Morris and Associates that would hold all the statistics for standard industry classification codes. And what RMA did at the time, Robert Morris and Associates, was anybody that borrowed money from a bank, Matt, the banks turned all that financial data over to RMA. And they'd do it by size of company. You know, is it 5 million or less? Is it? And they'd break it out by category. So we could take our industry, we could take our area, and we could look and see what was the return on capital, how much inventory did they typically have, and how often did they turn the inventory? What was their pre-tax profitability, right? All of that data was there, and our managers were highly incentivized to get in the top 2 to 5%.
Well, let's talk about that for a moment, just going back to your success in owning manufacturing businesses. I think you own 5 of them, if I'm correct.
Yes. And let's say 5 that have made money, Matt.
Okay, 5 that have made money, and you told, I put some notes here, and you called it a culture of success, and you called it unusual success, and you fit within that 95th percentile, you know, the best 2 to 5% of your cohorts or your peers in that particular manufacturing business. Can you kind of just kind of walk us, I think you shed a little bit of light around the incentive systems that you put in place for your employees. But I know you, from our conversations, you were very generous. And when you had these exits, you went above and beyond to take care of your team and some of these folks that were p- pivotal in your performance. But can you talk about the culture that you had in these manufacturing businesses and maybe a couple other things that really helped you fall in this 2-5% category?
I'd be glad to, Matt. I don't want to put you in a tough spot, right? Because, you know, your employees might look at what I'm about to say and look at Christopher and it might put you in a tough spot. So if you really want to pursue, I'll proceed.
No, please, please do, because listen, it's not just about me. And I always take what you say and, you know, I always think about how I could apply it. And there's others who are going to listen to this and they're probably, if they're smart, they're probably going to think the same way. So please don't hold back. We want to hear about how you did it.
Matt, with that caveat, if we could perform in the top 2-5%, we had a very profitable company that would cash flow extremely well. So we had a system in place, and it would start at about 10% net pre-tax profitability. At 10% or below, we didn't have a big bonus or profit sharing program. We had one, but it was relatively modest, like most companies.
Okay.
It might be 3%, you know, of profitability or something like that. What some people might even do on employee match on their salary, but, you know, in this case, maybe for the whole company. But our companies, Matt, typically would run in the high 20s of net pre-tax profitability.
Okay.
If you think about how that cash flows and your people are managing their inventories, they're managing your capital expenses, then we had extreme cash flow. In fact, there was a point in time with one of the companies that was in the shooting sports industry where I'd tell people it was the closest thing to a legalized printing press for money I've ever seen in my life, and that still holds true today.
Wow.
That company today is a Bushnell company. But we would give, on a sliding scale, up to 20% of our net pre-tax profits to all of our employees, not just our managers, to all of our employees. If you think about what that meant, Matt, it meant that every fifth day, one day of every week, we treated our employees like they owned the whole company's cash flow. We didn't just turn our managers into profit centers. Every one of our employees was thinking profit all the time. And how do you generate the profit? It's not just through the numbers. It's that old saying, Matt, that nobody cares how much you know until they know how much you care. So at one point in time, in my frustration, I was asking for business cards to be printed. My administrative assistant, and I asked for the business card to be printed without a title. My administrative assistant pushed back on that and said, Brad, you're the president and CEO. You can't be running all over the world handing out business cards with no title. And I told her, please just do what I've asked. Well, she rounded up a few other managers and they came in and they were on her side. And it's, you know, Brad needed to have president and CEO. And I was frustrated, Matt, that day. And I told them, if I'm the chief executive of anything around here, I'm the chief executive servant. It's my job to serve customers of this company. It's my job to serve the employees of this business. It's my job to serve the vendors and to serve other shareholders. So please just go and do what I said. Matt, about 5 days later, guess what I got? I got business cards and the title was Chief Executive Servant. I got more comments for the rest of my career out of handing out cards that had Chief Executive Servant than Chief Executive Officer.
I think that's classic servant.
Not only did we have the profit sharing plan, Matt, little things. I don't remember in 45 years when we had hundreds of employees ever denying someone time off for any reason. We had a life-threatening illness policy that if an employee or their wife or one of their children had a life-threatening illness, that we pay their salary and their benefits in full for as long as it took for them to beat that challenge and be able to come back to work. We had one case where we did that, Matt, for over 3.5 years, and our people, because they knew how much we care, would not take advantage of it. An example of that would be, I came to work one day in the factory, and a dad that had a 7-year-old daughter that was fighting for her life with cancer, and they had to fly her to Seattle, was at work instead of being with his daughter on the day that she was going to go through treatment. And I asked that individual why they were there. And their response was, because my wife has taken my daughter and she can take care of her. And Matt, I had to respond, you don't understand the reason for this policy. You got a wife and a child that are probably scared to death of what this outcome could be. And they need their dad with them or their husband with them. So I told them, you go home, you pack your bags, and by the time you get back here, we'll have a one-way ticket for you to fly out to Seattle. And the company, of course, would pay that. We'll pay your salary. Matt, those are the kinds of things that we implemented. And what we found was it generated extreme loyalty with our people. We had a waiting list for people that wanted to apply and work at our company. And we didn't have to basically fire anyone. Our other employees would chase them out the door if they weren't performing.
I love that. That's great. I mean, I think you're an example for us entrepreneurs that are out there in terms of building a culture and a brand where you're going to engender fierce loyalty from your team. And the way to do that is to, it sounds like, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but to serve. Just what was on your business card, chief servant officer. And I think that you're a hell of an example for the rest of us. And it's amazing. It really is. And I guess proof is in the pudding, right? And that's
not, if there's anything I've learned, people would tell me you can't afford to give 20% of your net pre-tax profit. You can't afford to have that life-saving or life-threatening illness policy. That's even after all that, we're still performing in the top 5%. Tell me you can't afford it. And tell me if a small business like what ours were, Matt, or Crystalview, if we could afford to do that, you tell me that Microsoft,
Amazon,
NVIDIA,
yeah,
Amazon, Apple can't afford to do that. They choose not to, Matt.
Yeah.
What I think the common theme was that was frustrating for me throughout my career was I'd hear people all the time talk about how important their employees are to them, how their employees are their most important asset. And Matt, what I learned is if you want to know where someone's heart really is, don't listen to what they say. Watch where they write their checks.
Isn't that the truth?
We wrote our checks back to our employees.
As we
write our checks today to the foundation.
It separates conversation from conviction, right?
Matt, if your goal and objective in life, this has been my experience, at least I can only speak for me and my wife, if our only goal and objective was to make money, what a shallow life.
I mean, it's amazing what you've done and what you've built. Before we get into the foundation, which I want to spend some time on, you've built this amazing culture. You built this brand. You were in the top 2 to 5%. Can you just real quickly tell us kind of your mindset around the exits that you've had, why you decided to exit? Did you build these companies to hold them for, let's say, a 3, 5, 10 year holding period? And set, because I think you sold to PE shops, if I'm not mistaken, for the most.
You know, Matt, the one company ultimately, as I just mentioned, is a Bushnell company. The other company is in the family, stayed in the family, okay, but my uncle's side of the family. The third business went to a PE group. And then we have two businesses that we're still involved with, small manufacturing and startup that we were involved with. I never built a business to sell it. I never built a business to monetize it. What happened on the first two sales, because we had two businesses at once, one in the photographic industry, one in the shooting sports industry, is my partner, who he and I got along great as partners, but he had a hard time staying married, Matt. Okay. And he had five wives.
Wow.
And one day his fifth wife came to me and said that she wanted me as the CEO of the company. He was out of the business at that time. He wasn't active in business. And she came to me and said that she wanted me to make her and her children executives in the company. And if I refused to do that, she'd make my life hell, quote unquote.
Wow.
And I told her the only way you can make my life hell is if I am willing to allow it. And so I chose to exit.
Okay.
So now I'm in my later 30s. I got to decide, do you retire or do you get back into business? And one of the gentlemen that I worked with, that was my production manager, he and I went out and we looked at over 150 different opportunities and didn't find something that seemed to work for us. And the state of Montana contacted me and said that there was a business over in Missoula, Montana, that was in the dental medical space that was for sale. And so we went over and looked at it, Matt. We, for a variety of reasons, we made an offer, but the deal didn't close. A competitor of theirs bought the company, ran it for a year, shut it down, and 130 some people were out of work.
Wow.
The state of Montana came to us, and the employees had remembered that Montana guy was looking at buying the company, and they came to us and asked if we'd like to do a startup from ground zero and compete with the company that had they bought us out and shut them down. And so we agreed to do that. And Matt, when it was all said and done 25 years later, not only did we have the private equity exit, but we were the second largest provider of those kind of products in the world behind the company that had shut the old business down. So every dollar that we took in sales and profit came right out of their hides generally. And our people were highly motivated to do a good job. When they asked about starting the business, I told them under one condition. And they asked me what that was. And I said that you become my partners, not our employees. And so we created an environment where they could immediately own 20% of the company.
And that's how you built that company up. And ultimately that ended up being another exit for you in the PE space, right?
Yep. Okay. So if you think about it, they got 20% of the cash flow, plus they had their 20% that they own through the company, Matt. And it was a formula that just worked really, really well for us. In a business that typically has 30% turnover, think about this number as a businessman. Manufacturing typically has a 30% turnover every year. Our average turnover per year for 25 years was 2%. Our people didn't leave.
Who could blame them?
And we wouldn't kick them out the door. There was no mandatory retirement age. We wouldn't kick them out the door and they wouldn't leave.
So that 20% of profits, how would you make the determination? I would guess it wasn't equal based off headcount. I would presume you had some system based off of meritocracy or value creation where you would they could participate in that 20%. Can you perhaps share how you set that up?
I can. Yeah. And by the way, it's a great question, Matt. How do we do that fairly? So we took half that number, half that 20%, and it was based off our overall payrolls and what your percentage of the overall payroll was. So our managers, our supervisors, we get more than a person that was just brought on.
Okay. Okay.
The other half went equally to everybody. Hmm. You got the same check if you were just hired.
Wow.
And you'd been with us a year, you got the same check I got.
That's amazing.
And we found, what a thrill for my wife and I to hand those checks out and have people just cry.
I bet.
Have people ask you, do you know how much money this is, Brad? And Matt, what a thrill to be able to say, yeah, look who signed the front of the check.
I better know.
I better know. It's exactly right.
And you followed this same approach when you sold too, didn't you?
You know, Matt, in one of the questions you asked me about the exiting and maybe mistakes or how you'd prep for an exit. And when I told you that I didn't prep for any exit, that we didn't plan on selling the company, that the reason that the company was even marketed was I had my professional team, attorneys, accountants, financial advisors, and others in a meeting. And towards the end of the meeting, the accountant asked me a question. And they said, Brad, if you died suddenly, you know, there's certain things you had a habit of doing in your life, like ride motorcycles and jump out of airplanes and fly private airplanes and things. If you died suddenly, what would it look like if Capri had to run your business? Could she run it? And if she couldn't run it and it had to be sold, what would that look like? I thought about that. And while I told you we had a very, very capable and competent management team, and I had the opportunity throughout my career to work with some of the very, very finest people you'd ever could imagine. Wonderful, marvelous people. But Matt, I hired thoroughbreds. The only way you get in the top 2 to 5% is you got to hire in the top 2 to 5%.
Yeah.
A company is nothing more than its sum total of all of its employees. Right. So we worked that hiring process extremely diligently, way harder than the average company. Most people couldn't make it through an interview.
Well, it makes sense.
When they got to the interview process and the interview, everyone had to ultimately have me in the interview. And Matt, I'd tell them, my job in this interview is to chase you away. And why? Because only 5% of the people are meant to work here. That means 19 out of 20 aren't meant to work here. Are you that 19? Are you that one?
Yeah.
Because if you're not that one, you're not going to fit in well here. If you won't make a commitment to yourself, your family, to this company, to your fellow workers, you just won't be a good fit. And so they asked me that question, and I thought about what it would be like to manage the managers and manage our team. And now she's going through the grief of losing her husband. Our competitors were tough competitors, man. The medical dental industry can be a tough, brutal business because there's a lot of dollars involved. And I looked at that and I said, you know what? I'm not going to say I would sell the company, but I can understand that if I'm gone, it's going to be tough. So we'll at least pursue the idea. And so I allowed them to hire an investment banking group and to see if we could sell our company. And I think from that standpoint, Matt, the biggest compliment that I have for my team members, all of our employees, I mean, we ran about 130 people or so. I was one person out of 130. So let's make sure that we understand this isn't about Brad. This is about 129 other people. They built a company that when the private equity group took it to market, and when I wouldn't let the private equity group talk to the top 8 buyers, with one of them being the company that had bought the old company and shut them down.
Yeah.
And it was very important to us that those jobs stay in Montana and the company stay viable. So that meant it needed to go to somebody that it was a strategic acquisition and a platform company, not some business that they're already in. We wouldn't let them talk to 8 people, Matt. We got 27 offers for our company.
Wow.
When I asked the private equity firm how often that happened, a year, I was like, well, how often a year it is, you know, you represent someone and they get 27 offers. He said, Brad, you're asking the wrong question. The question is how often it might happen in a decade. And the answer to that is once, and you're it.
So
that says more, Matt, I think, than anything I could ever say about what our people accomplished, how proud I am of them, what an outstanding business they built. And it was all predicated on that the industry knew that we were doing the very best we could to make the very best products we could for dental professionals and for the medical community.
So any regrets there? I mean, you built this world-class culture with thoroughbreds, as you call it, which I have to agree. I mean, that's a painstaking process to find the best of the best. And that's what we strive to do at Crystal View. You're only as good as your team and your people. And it sounds like you guys have done a fantastic job on building your team out with top talent. If you look back and say, man, if only I held them another 5-10 years and the multiples were such, and I know you're not in it for the money, but the whole team could have generated a higher return. Is that even part of your thought process or is?
Well, you know, you asked about prepping the company for sale because we didn't. The people that bought it thought I was the dumbest guy on the planet, Matt. Why? Because if I'd made decisions to prep the company for sale that they made afterward, they would have paid me $15 million more for it.
Yeah.
So they, in their mind, I left $15 million on the table and I could have had that over a 1 or 2 year period if I just prepped it for sale. But the idea of prepping the company for sale wasn't
even a part of the process.
No, because we might not have sold it And because I was looking at the long range future, I was never looking at next quarter or even next year. I was looking at where are we going to be 3 years, 5 years, 7 years, 10 years from now. That was important to me. To answer your other question, as a young guy, think about that one day you're the CEO of Crystal View, and at 12:01, 1 minute past midnight, you get to tell your wife you're unemployed.
She might not like that very much. So I think you just answered my question. I was going to ask, a lot of these PE shops, they'll retain the founder. There'll be an earn out. They need you there for the next 2 years. You sign a non-compete. It sounds like none of that really occurred here.
Matt, they made it very clear that they didn't want me to stay in the company because they had a different management philosophy.
And how did that work?
Do you think that they give 20% of the net pre-tax profits out? Do you think that they have the life-threatening illness policy?
No.
So they knew that I'd be advocating for that. So I'd be in conflict with them.
Sure.
And that's fair, Matt. That's reasonable.
Yeah. And how did
just the fact that I would do it and my wife and I would do it together and we believed in that doesn't mean that we had a right to impose that on a new buyer or anybody else.
Well, it's interesting if you look at your management philosophy versus the, you know, the typical PE management philosophy in the long run. How did it end up? And I don't know if you've tracked this or not, but how did it end up working out for them? I know one of your companies is now a Bushnell company, as you mentioned, but
it's worked out very well for them.
Okay.
Matt, because we were what they referred to as a platform company, and we did not know it at the time, but they were already working with the buyer that said, if you can get Brad's company and combine it with your company, we'll buy the whole thing because that's how much we want Brad's company. And so within 9 months of them buying it, they had flipped their whole company to another private equity firm.
So back, let's rewind for a minute. You said 12:01, you look at your wife and you say you're unemployed.
Well, that was true.
What did you do?
A lot of people would say they're retired, but I viewed it as I was unemployed.
So you rolled out of bed that day, you sold your companies, you had a fabulous exit, you changed the lives of all the people that worked for you. I'm sure you felt incredible. What was the next step in your life?
The hardest day, Matt, in that process, because I think this is one of the questions you're asking, was my wife and I weren't going to go out the back door. So we got our whole company together, got all the people together. Before we closed, we're going to tell them that we had arranged to sell the company, that we had found the very, very best buyer that we thought we could, that would continue the business, keep the jobs in Montana, that we had signed a 10-year lease on the building to assure that, and that we had other commitments that would help assure that. But we wanted to have the opportunity to thank every one of them personally, and that there would be one more day that we've asked the new buyers to allow us to come into the company, and that would be to hand out checks to all of our employees from the sale proceeds.
Wow.
That was a hard day. That evening, telling our team that we had sold the company, it was more difficult than I anticipated. And the reason was I was not prepared for all the tears. I was not prepared. I was prepared that some of the women might cry, but I wasn't prepared to have so many men cry. And my wife and I were overwhelmed with the love, the respect, the compassion that our employees showed to us, the understanding that they showed. There was no resentment, no bitterness. It was, we understand, we get it. We just, man, when you hear things like best job I've ever had, best boss I ever worked for, never going to have another one. I know it. It was hard.
I bet. And I'm sure you still have friends to this day of your executive team and your staff and your team that you stay in close contact with, where you've changed their lives for the best.
You know, some of them retired, Matt. They did well enough on the sale. You know, some of them retired. But what it really did for us is it gave us the capital for the first time in our lives. You get a big check. And after you pay your taxes, Matt, it gave us the capital to set up the family office and the foundation. And those were things that were near and dear to our heart. And so if you look at the positive side of the sale, that was certainly one of those positive sides.
So I think that's a great segue. God Forgives Foundation. Can you kind of just help us understand the name behind it, what it meant to you, why it's near and dear to you, what you're working on presently, and why it's impacted and really pulled your heartstrings so much, you and both you and your wife Capri.
Sure, glad to, Matt. I was raised as a Christian, a young man. I had a Christian mom and dad, strong faith. My mom especially was just an unbelievable strong woman of faith and prayer warrior. But like a lot of young people, through my college years, Matt, and right after, while if a terrorist or someone had grabbed me and told me to renounce my faith in Jesus Christ or they'd shoot me in the head, I'd tell them, pull the trigger. But I wasn't living my life every day for the Lord. I was not living my faith. And so one evening I'm watching a television show, and in the show, which by the way, I've never found in God's word specifically, but Simon Peter is giving the Lord a hard time for going to Matthew's house. And the Lord rebukes him. And his response to him was, "Forgive me, Lord, for I am nothing but a stupid, sinful man." And Matt, for whatever reason, you hear about Christians that are born again that quick. I'm crying, sitting there, and I'm thinking, I'm Simon Peter. I've been lately a stupid, sinful man. But that's not where my heart is, and that's not where I want to continue to live. So I want to change that. And so I committed to do that. So now, Matt, I've committed to the Lord, right, that I'm going to live my life for you. I want to serve you, serve humanity. I want to do a much better job. But what do you want me to do? Why am I on this earth? And he was very clear, Matt, in explaining to me, I want you to be a businessman. I want you to create jobs. I want you to run the company as a ministry first and a business second. I want you to trust me. I want you to be super generous. And I want to see if you can outgive me, Brad. And the one thing I've learned is you can't outgive God. And so, Matt, that had a transformed Brad, a different mind, a different heart, a different personality. And so ever since that moment, I was 27 when that occurred. Ever since that moment, I've had the pleasure, Matt, of knowing exactly why I was put on this earth and exactly what the God that created the universe wanted me to do. I can't tell you how rewarding that is, Matt. When you know that you were an accident, as the old saying goes, it didn't go from the goo to the zoo to you. You're not an accident of a Big Bang Theory, Brad. I created you for one thing. I created you to create jobs, drive an economy, show the world that a business leader doesn't have to be all about the numbers and hard business, that you can have a heart and you can have compassion, and that you can care about people and care about your customers and care about your employees, Matt. And that set myself down that path where it's just been a privilege. It's been a joy. Obviously, there's been an amount of success. So when you ask about the name of the foundation, What is the greatest gift that I feel God has given me and everyone that comes to him is it's the gift of forgiveness, redemption.
Yeah, amazing.
I believe in the prodigal son story because I kind of view myself as the prodigal son.
It's an amazing story. And a lot of your work right now, I know, is in India, and it revolves around orphanages. And let me first say this, you know, speaking on behalf of myself and the entire Crystal View team, it is really enlightening, and it's so inspiring for us to see the work that you do. And we're so appreciative and blessed that you've allowed us to be a part of it, and naming a house after Crystal View. And when our team sees that, back to what you were talking about in your manufacturing business, you know, when you could cut people in and when they think like an owner, but if you could show people like on our team what they're doing, there's more value than just driving net operating income. Where could we increase rents, occupancy? Where could we cut costs? All of that is fantastic. And that's what drives the business forward. But when we show them because of what we're doing and because of the profitability that we earn as a GP, we're donating and we're giving back to causes and philanthropies like God Forgives. And they could see there's a direct impact and link from their efforts to you know, saving a child's life and providing them with an education. It's just an absolute game changer. So I want to first thank you and Capri for letting us be a part of that. But perhaps you could talk a little bit more about what you're doing in India. And I think you're also in the Caribbean right now, or you're thinking about going down there.
Yeah, Matt, I want to thank you for allowing Capri and I the opportunity to at one point talk to the whole Crystal View team. And, you know, we weren't there to raise money for God Forgives. My wife and I funded 100% ourselves, typically.
I had to bend your arm to let me in.
We don't ask other people for funds, right? You and your family have been extremely generous to God Forgives as individuals, and we appreciate that. And we appreciate you giving us the opportunity to meet with the Crystal View people so that we could tell them that from our perspective, how important the work that they do and the returns that they give and the impact that that has on the lives of children, in this case in India. And, you know, you gave us that that privilege to meet with your team and to explain that to them so that it wasn't just dollars and cents. We wanted them to understand you're having a direct impact on lives. And, Matt, here's some shocking realities. 80% of the girls in our orphanages, if they didn't show up in the orphanage, if we didn't build that orphanage and bring them into that embrace along in team with Angel House, if we didn't do that, 80% of the girls, by the time they're young women, 18 to 21, would be sold into sex slavery, they'd be abused, or they'd be prostitutes. 80%. So we wanted your team to understand that you are totally transforming these lives, number one. Number two, in India, as you and your family know, but some of the viewers may not know, they have a caste system. And on our website, where we have Leah's Lighthouse, which was named after Capri's mom, it kind of tells that story. But in that caste system, these orphans are rejected. Unless there's a mom and a dad or a pastor and his wife or something that take them in, the caste system rejects them. It's karma. Something had to happen in their lives, their parents' lives, the grandparents' lives that created this environment for them. And it's karma in a caste system. When we built Leah's Lighthouse, those children went from a hut, there are seven children at the time, that a couple was taking care of. They went from a hut with no doors, Matt, and, you know, I think you've seen the video, but anyway, no doors. It leaked through the roof when it would rain, and they get a lot of monsoon rain there and stuff. It went from that to the only two-story building in the village, the nicest building in the village, the only freshwater well in the village. These children had never seen a bed. They'd never seen a pillow. They didn't even know what shoes were. And all of a sudden, through the grace of Crystal View, and the work we do with you and the vesting we do with you, these children had books, they're going to school, they had the shoes and seen a pillow in the bed. And all of a sudden, the caste system and the karma, Matt, they went from here to up here.
That's amazing.
Totally transformed their lives. Now you look at what they're doing as young adults, the jobs, the careers, nurses, teachers, total transformation of lives. And so we're so appreciative of the work that you guys have allowed us to do, because, you know, you're our single biggest investment, but we take the cash flow that we receive, our distributions that we get, you know, each quarter, yeah. You, Matt,
yeah.
We take that cash flow and we use it to fund the foundation to build these orphanages. And, you know, our dream originally, to answer your question, was we thought if we built one orphanage that we could fund to stay open for generations, multi-generations. My wife and I thought that that would have been a pretty neat thing to do and extremely rewarding. We just opened the 10th orphanage.
Wow.
We're building two a year through a lot of the work that Crystal View is doing.
That's amazing.
But not only that, Matt, we've been able to leverage and double the team in India. And we have so many people, not for God Forgives, but through the Angel House side, that are willing and wanting to build orphanages, that we funded a whole separate team of people so that we can double the amount of orphanages that get built, because we just ran out of infrastructure and people, and that adds about another 30 to 40 a year.
Wow.
So we're, you know, that old surfer boy, right, that I'm 71 years old, but the guy that grew up in Southern California, I'm pretty stoked about that.
Well, I got to tell you,
it's pretty groovy, Matt.
I do too. I really do. And to be a part of this and, you know, the faith that you've had in us to make the investment that you have to be your single largest investment. Believe me when I tell you, my team and I, we don't take it lightly. And, you know, we work tirelessly to deliver for you and the rest of the unit holders in the funds that we sponsor. And what a unique honor and privilege to see that these returns, they're whatever they go for, they go for to our investors. But to see what you're doing with the returns that we're delivering, it's just icing on the cake, you know?
Well, you know, Matt, you'd asked, mentioned the Caribbean, and that's where we got our start,
yep,
early. And we were down in Honduras and on the island of Roatan. And we were looking through Honduras, and we're looking at building an orphanage there. And there was an orphanage that was already there, but they were trying to build a school, and they didn't have the funds to build the school. So the God Forgives Foundation funded the school. And while we were going through that experience and touring different orphanages, we were at a Catholic orphanage in the mainland, Guatemala City, in Guatemala instead of Honduras. And there was a little girl that was about 3 years old that just was delivered the day before. And we met her in the hallway, and she was hiding behind the skirt of a sister. Matt, she just had her little hands on her dress and just peeking around,
yeah,
from the corner of her dress. And being a dad that had girls, you know, you realize the first thing you need to do is get down to their size so we don't look so intimidating, especially as men. So I got down on my knees, and I just put my arms out to give her a hug. And that little girl came running from behind the sister's skirt, jumped into my arms, and gave me the biggest hug. And there was an interface that occurred. And at that point, I was done for, so to speak. And I knew exactly what we were going to do. And I knew then that my wife and I would set up God Forgives Foundation, and that we would fund orphanages, and we'd help little girls like Mercedes, was her name. And Mercedes forever changed my life.
You know, you've said it, that faith is a competitive advantage, and it certainly sounds like it has been in your life and your manufacturing businesses and how you've taken care of your, you know, your team and your employees. And it's interesting, just going back to that for a moment, you know, from my I don't have any experience being in the manufacturing industry, but from the research I've done, a lot of it is cyclical. You know, it's buying at the bottom and selling at a trough. It sounds like your advantage has been your faith and your team and the belief that you've had and the people that work with you. And it sounds like you're applying what you've learned through your past business experience to what you're doing in philanthropy, both on the statistics side. You know, you're using the competitive advantage you have with faith and statistics to really grow these orphanages. You said that you went from one, now you're at 10. Who knows how many you're going to build next year? It just sounds like such an amazing journey. But perhaps you could just take a moment and talk about how faith has been that competitive and almost unfair advantage in God Forgives.
And I really believe that, Matt. I really believe that an individual's faith, if they embrace it strong enough, gives them a real clear competitive advantage. Number one, from the Christian faith is all I can talk about. You know, the Christian faith made it very clear that there's no greater love than to give our life for someone else, to support widows and orphans. But Matt, when you have an attitude of gratitude, and you have an attitude of generosity, then your customers see that, and you live that. The loyalty I've learned that you get is incredible. And one example that I just give you is we had a customer in Argentina. We were in 65 countries around the world, all the way from Mexico to Argentina. Most people would understand that Argentina's had a series of economic challenges and collapses over the decades.
Sure.
And this family was caught in one of those, and their business was caught in those. And the government had put export controls out and capital controls, and they couldn't get certain money out. And the safety deposit boxes that they had at the banks were all rifled by the government, and anything that was there was taken. And so the owner, the grandpa, called me up and was apologizing that he couldn't pay me, explained the situation, felt really bad, and we arranged to meet shortly thereafter. So showed me pictures, explained the situation, and Matt, my faith allowed me, I just felt compelled to tell him, as far as the east is from the west, sunrise from sunset, that's what I want you to feel that debt is. It is gone. It's forgiven. You don't owe it to me. And when you get your feet back on the ground, you won't ever owe it to me. Fast forward about 20 years, the grandson's taking over the business. The grandfather has asked me to mentor the grandson. And when they're announcing that the grandson's taking over the business, the grandson tells me, I've been told by my grandpa and my father that I'm supposed to sell your products in front of everybody else's. We're supposed to give your company most effort because of what you did for our family years ago. And so what I've learned, Matt, is we can't outgive God. And when other humans see our hearts, if they're pure and they really care about them, they'll care back. And so we had those committed employees, number one. We had the committed customers, number two. And then, Matt, the third thing I can tell you is through my faith, I don't put my trust in my balance sheet. So when one individual will hesitate, or they'll be concerned about, what if I lose, right? The money's the most important thing to me. The money's my security. How can I afford to risk my capital for my retirement or for whatever? And he comes up against the individual that through his faith says, it's all God's. He owns it all. I just have the privilege to manage it. And if he wants me to put it on the table, I'm all chips in. And a discussion that Capri and I have had when we first met, and she was suggesting that maybe her husband had some unique personality traits that helped in business. And I didn't feel that way, Matt. I felt anybody could do what I've done, and there's nothing special about myself. And she said, no, there's one thing that I've seen with you that I think makes it special. And I said, what's that? She said, more than any man I've ever seen, you'll put the chips on the table and push them all in because you're trusting God to make it work. You do your homework with the team. Sure. You do your homework. You reduce the risk. You look at all those statistical possibilities and probabilities of loss and gain. But when you feel that God has called you to push it all in, you go all in for the foundation, all in for the family office, right? All in for a friendship.
Well, there is the faith, and you know, the returns speak for themselves. I mean, look what you've been able to build over your lifetime and your foundation and your businesses and the loyalty and the friendships. I mean, it's quite remarkable. I do have a question for those that are moved by what you're doing. Me being at the top of the list, is there a website for Leah's Lighthouse or for anybody that does want to get involved in God Forgives? Is that door open for people to be a part of it financially?
No, Matt, once again, another great question, and thank you for asking it. There was a period of time where I told our team that I felt God had called us to this task and that we would not ask for any money from any other source, that it would be ours, that we would invest and that we'd spend for the foundation. But, you know, you and your family have, by the way, influenced me when you asked if there was a way that you could participate and help. And when we started looking at nonprofits, my wife and I, we were shocked, man, at how many nonprofits, what percentage actually goes to the mission that they say that they're founded for. We were shocked at how much goes to executive salaries, how much goes to raising funds, how much goes to overhead, how much goes to travel, all these things. And for God Forgives, like when your family was so generous and we told you and your wife that 100 cents of every dollar was going to go building that orphanage. Why? We don't take any salaries. We don't charge any overhead. We pay personally for our people's travel and their salaries and everything else. None of that has been run through the foundation. But what I'm realizing now, Matt, is it's harder for people to really know if they do donate somewhere, is it really where the rubber meets the road?
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't want to say that, yes, we would be willing to take funds, you know, or donations from others other than people we have a close relationship, like with you and your family. But I don't think I should say no either at this point, Matt. I should probably hedge my bets here and say, you know, let me think about coming fund.
Here's the trade.
Think about this one. If what we're doing touches hearts, if people go to GodForgivesFoundation.com, look at the videos, if any of that touches people's hearts, then maybe I need to be willing to consider something different. Maybe once again, it's an opportunity for us to grow and to help more and more children than we are.
Yeah,
but that was not part of the plan, and it's not something that we're pursuing.
Understood. And listen, we want to respect that. It means a lot to us, my wife and I, and the Crystal View team. And we can't think of a better place to donate money. But if anyone feels similar to us, perhaps they could just take a look at Lee's lighthouse and see some of the work you're doing. And when the time is right and you know, you and your wife feel compelled to really grow at a higher pace and scale, then perhaps others can get involved.
And, you know, Matt, also, if helping orphans is something that people want to do, but even if it's, it could be with God Forgives maybe, but even if not, we'll steer them in the right direction.
Okay.
We'll steer them to partners that we have or people that we know that are doing a great job.
Wonderful. Wonderful. What would be the main website, would you say, for folks to visit if they just wanted to learn more?
To go to GodForgivesFoundation.com.
Okay.
www.GodForgivesFoundation.com.
Wonderful. Let me ask you this, my friend. It's been an amazing time. I can't believe how fast the time has gone here. But what advice could you give somebody who aspires, you know, some life lessons that you've learned, one or two that kind of stand out for somebody that really wants to build a lasting business that's going to have a tremendous impact on the community and to serve their people and their customers and their staff and their vendors like you have, and then to one day give it all back, because that is your goal. Correct me if I'm wrong. You want to give it all back before you die, you and your wife, through this foundation. Maybe you could just speak about
that. Is our, Matt, that is our goal. And it's driven by the idea that we still have people ask us about, you know, owning the two small businesses we have or running a family office, you know, and being your own boss type thing and making your own decisions. And I tell them, that's not how we view it. We have 10 orphanages, 25 children each. There's 250 children. Matt, I work for them. And I work for the hundreds of children that are yet to come. They're my boss. And on top of them is the Lord, but they're my boss. I don't view it that I own it. We view it that God owns it. We have the privilege to manage it. It's all His anyway. So we'll give it all to Him throughout our lives and at the end of our lives. If you're asking about what I've learned from a business standpoint, I've learned that I tease people myself, Matt. I read one too many Inc. magazines when I was young. I had to get deprogrammed. I had to learn that the way the world would lead me in business is not necessarily the best way. That the dog eat dog, cut each other's throats, right? Anything to get it to the bottom line. Think short term, thinks in months or quarters instead of decades. But I'm a real advocate for people owning and running their own companies. And what I've learned is that idea that I don't know where it came from, but the idea became popular of fake it till you make it. And Matt, I've learned that's the absolute wrong way to approach life and business. Don't fake a thing. Learn to love your people. Learn to love your customers. Learn to love your vendors. Learn to love yourself. If you truly have that in your heart, people will know it's not fake. And how do they know? What I shared earlier. Where do you put your money? Where do you, not what you say, what are you doing that's showing that you really care about them? And my experience has been, Matt, once business owners put this attitude of service first, and not because they're trying to make more money, because in their heart, they really believe that that's the best thing to do. What we try to do every day is to treat all of the people we're coming into contact with the way we'd hope they would treat us and the way that we think God would want us to treat them. I think in our society today, Matt, we've become too short-term oriented and we've become too focused on chasing things that really don't matter. And what really matters is our family and our faith, right? Our relationships, our marriages, these are the things that last. And, you know, I've never had one of my children ever ask me what my net worth is. I don't think they care. First, they know it's not coming to them. Dad's already made clear with mom that they're giving it away. They've made clear that we're invited to help run a family office and to help run a foundation someday if our hearts desire. But I think, Matt, what I've learned through this whole process and had the good fortune to have had all the experiences in business and our family. You know, our family office beats the norm, Matt.
Yeah,
we outperform investment companies and groups. Our returns are, once again, we try to get in that top 2 to 5%. We work every day to do that. But my appeal to people, if there's anything they could learn from our experiences, Matt, is I've learned that if you approach it from the right attitude, maybe this will change, Matt. But so far, Capri and I have not been able to outgive God. When it was one orphanage, and that was where it is, he said, nope, I'm going to bless you so there's more. And then all of a sudden, it went from 1 to 2, then 2 to 30 to 40 a year, and supporting a team. And Matt, through companies like yours and Christoview, he keeps continuing to bless us with the cash flow and the profitability that we need to go after our mission with passion and with energy.
Well, what a tremendous legacy. And I'm just blessed to have known you and to be a part of this journey. It's been incredible. And I'm looking forward to what the future holds. I think we're getting started, my friend. And
Eric, too.
I could tell you.
We got two orphanages named after Crystal, you know. Over Gold Glossary and your team's efforts and their work. And somehow I don't think the Crystal View houses are over yet.
I don't think so either. We've got plenty more to build together. And thank you and Capri and your whole team for letting us be a part of it. It's been an amazing journey. And I thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Matt. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Brad.
Have a good afternoon. Thanks.
You too.
Bye-bye.